Hey everyone, I found the record button on Zoom, so I'm super stoked. Welcome to Office Hours with Cloud Posse, your weekly dose of insider DevOps trends, Terraform insights, all sourced from our SuiteOps community, and a live Q&A you can't find anywhere else. It's June 19th, 2024. I'm your host, Eric Osterman. Real quick, I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. We're a DevOps accelerator for funded startups and enterprises that helps teams who are overwhelmed with AWS. And we do this by leveraging our over 200 plus Terraform modules that have been battle tested and downloaded over 100 million times. So no matter where you find yourself on this journey, our team is here to help you out. If you're curious if we can move the needle for you at your company, book a meeting with us at cloudposse.com/meet. Again, cloudposse.com/meet. You'll book a meeting with me directly and we'll go through your situation. From there, let's move on to how you can maximize today's session. First off, our format is very informal. Engage as much as you'd like, ask questions. And if you're curious about any of our open source tools or modules, go for it. And for those of you on the recording, we host these calls live. So if you want to register and attend and ask your own questions, go to cloudposse.com/office hours. Again, cloudposse.com/office hours. So with that said, let's jump into some announcements. All right. Just a bunch of things that came across my newsfeed. One of those, I mean, honestly, I support it. There's something ironic about it. So MongoDB had their own licensing snafu, if you will, and changed to a source available license, I believe, much like what HashiCorp did. MongoDB is suspected to be somewhat involved in the whole negative press that came out about is OpenTofu fork showing us the wrong way how to fork? Well, the guy who wrote that had some affiliation with MongoDB. I forget the details of it. Anyways, MongoDB has submitted their provider key to the HashiCorp registry. To the OpenTofu registry. That's just showing that they're going to start distributing their provider through the OpenTofu registry as well. All in all, good for OpenTofu, just some irony there. Matt,
yeah,
are you going to say?
Two quick things. One thing is the guy that wrote that article had a previous affiliation with MongoDB. I don't think he's currently associated with them. And second is license change, I think, is less controversial because it was really because they really did it because Amazon was essentially taking their entire product and just hosting it and completely taking away any way for them to be able to monetize their service. They were basically selling it cheaper than Mongo could sell it themselves. And Mongo needed to rely on Amazon in order to be able to sell it because they needed to pay them for hardware and all those things. And that was the reason they did it. So I think it's less controversial than HashiCorp's, at least in my view, but still it was a thing that started that way and then started open source and then changed at some point.
Of course that whole debate again, but yeah, I mean there was a little bit more sympathy in how it went. They more or less had one product line. HashiCorp had multiple. Terraform language as opposed to this as being a service. HashiCorp obviously argues that
I think The scope of their license is also like now basically just says you just can't host a competitive product to Atlas. And that's what the restriction is on their license, where like I feel like the HashiCorp license is impossible to understand without I don't know. I feel like without a degree in something, you can't figure out what the heck their intentions are in that whole thing. So this one is a little bit easier, at least that's my understanding of it.
Yeah, it feels like it was a bastardization of the BSL where they're just making it suit their needs in whatever way, but totally ambiguous. I am curious about the server side public license. Was this something that they invented Or was there an SSPL before this?
I think so. I think it, if you see, it's actually like copyrighted by them in 2018. So.
Yeah. All right. But this is at least more the way you would expect to see a real software license and not the BSL,
Yeah,
which is
and the associated FAQ with the BSL that is somehow incorporated into the license, which is like, I don't know. It just feels very half done.
right. Sorry. Don't want to rehash that. I could talk about it. All right. Well, perfect segue to the next topic. I don't know how big of a deal this is. I'm sure these kinds of things happen all the time.
Yeah.
There is.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know if they, you saw the. Sorry, introduce this thing and then I'll tell you. I'll give you the update at the end.
Related to what we were just talking about, or to.
No. This on this comment. On this
Oh, just
comment.
okay. So, yeah, let me
The
introduce the
lawsuit.
topic. Yeah, let me introduce the
Yeah.
topic and that. So, in other news, someone has raised a lawsuit in support of the investors of HashiCorp, ensuring that they got a good deal on the acquisition. That they're alleging that there was, well, Matt, why don't you introduce this one? I don't know it well enough.
Yeah, I mean the TLDR was that the a lawsuit was filed that basically claimed that there was a whole bunch of well the first claim is that the executives of HashiCorp were benefiting in a way that regular shareholders were not. They were essentially saying that Dave Janet and Armon have between them like $1 billion in shares and that are essentially locked up right now. This deal gives them the ability to unlock them and sell them on the public market without tanking the stock, but does not do what is in the best interest of the shareholders because the shareholders are just getting what has now been a depleted share price because of the change, of the license and a bunch of other things. It came it kept going down to 35 and then kind of like stayed there. So they're saying they're also saying that there's there are golden parachutes for each of them to leave, afterwards, and that all the financial disclosures of what agreements the management team has signed with IBM post-merger has not been disclosed in the registration with the SEC. On the sale of this. So they're actually saying that they don't have all the financial details of truly what the benefits are of all that. So all of that being said, the lawsuit was actually withdrawn voluntarily without HashiCorp responding to it. And there's a woman who's a tech executive who seems to be the named plaintiff, like if you find her, and she used to work for HashiCorp, but her official comment was that she had nothing to do with the lawsuit. So there's something fishy going on here about like how this thing got actually got like how it happened, or someone's lying, one of the two. But it seems very strange. Lawsuit got filed. IBM slash HashiCorp did not respond to the lawsuit, and then the lawsuit was voluntarily withdrawn with prejudice, so they can't refile it. So I don't really know what the heck's going on here, to be honest. It was a bizarre one for me when I read it. So I don't know if it's in this article, but somewhere like there was an update where they said that they withdrew it. No, that's just. Yeah, somewhere. Oh, there, maybe it is there. Yeah, on the bottom. Yeah, so I'm kind of clueless as to what's going on, but something weird is going on here. And the woman who says is the former employee and a shareholder and is the only person that logically seems to match up when you do a Google search of that name. says she says that she was not involved in this lawsuit. So I don't quite understand, what happened. Anyway, that's my head scratcher for the day.
I saw it. I can't connect the dots why that would be. All right. Well, we'll follow up with
And
some.
of course, the law firm is not answering, the request for comment, which doesn't surprise me. Law firms aren't generally, the ones. So Michelle Graff is the woman up there. If you search for her, there is a Michelle Graff that formerly worked for HashiCorp and does have, shares in HashiCorp, but she says she is not the one who filed this lawsuit. And it's not like it's, Michelle Smith, where there could be a lot of that's like a more unique name. So I don't know. Something strange seems to be going
Very interesting.
Or
Anyone ever?
someone got paid off. Someone got paid off quietly and is going about their business.
Could be.
Yeah.
Anyone have something else to add to this one? Okay. In other news, Atlantis, a popular project that kind of pioneered the whole area of GitOps as it relates to Terraform or IssueOps, as some call it, was accepted as a sandbox project into the CNCF project. We had a call for votes last week to help promote it, and I thought it was just really interesting how the CNCF runs the sandbox process. They have like their own GitHub app that collects the votes. So here you can kind of see how it all landed. So there were 200 plus votes for it from just observers of the project, you could say. And then in terms of like core members, I guess here, there were a total of 9 and 2 non-votes. All right, next announcement. We're developing some, well, okay. I don't know if it's even worth bringing up. Anyways, months ago, we brought up that we had opened a pull request against Terraform docs, and it was really hard to get it merged in because the maintainer is unavailable right now, going through some things. He has merged the pull request now, so we're very happy about that. Fixes a problem in Terraform docs that precluded us from showing certain outputs. As part of some of the work we're testing related to all of that, we discovered this Terraform provider, which is helpful if you're writing tests, for example, against your Terraform modules and want to ensure that you get certain kinds of warnings or errors from your Terraform code. I think some of this could be accomplished using native validation, but this is a way to have full control over that through a provider. And some, I think it, yeah, it uses resources here. I think it's interesting that it's using resources and not data sources for this, since I don't think these should be stateful. But, anyways, something to add to your tool chain if you have ever wanted to do that.
I'm going to try importing one of these resources.
All right, next one was something near and dear to my heart. We just released Atmos version 1.81, and this adds something that has been requested for a very long time, something that I was kind of personally against for a very long time, but have had a change of heart, mea culpa. So this pull request added a new template function in Atmos called Atmos component. And oops, that's linking to the preview site. Okay, so allow me to explain what this is doing. And we're working on a total overhaul of our Atmos documentation. Hopefully, it'll be released in less than a week, which will present a much better learning journey if you're getting you if you're interested in Atmos or working with Atmos and want to get better at using it. So one of the powerful things in Atmos is in the stack configurations, you can have Go style templates, and those templates can call functions. What we hadn't supported for a very long time was an easy way in a functional manner to get the configuration, the settings, and the outputs of any other component in your infrastructure. So in Atmos, the way you think about your infrastructure is you break it down into its pieces. Those pieces we call components, and you implement those components using Terraform root modules. Once you have all your Terraform root modules, now you have a configuration problem. So you solve your configuration using stacks, and stacks is how you combine all of those components that each have their own isolated Terraform state, loosely coupled, and you do that with your stacks. So when you decompose your infrastructure like this, the very first thing you start wondering is, well, how do I pass state between my components? Like, I have one component that provisions a VPC, one component that provisions a cluster and needs the VPC. How do I pass that information around? So we, or Cloud Posse has been pretty adamant about using Terraform for what Terraform's good at. And Terraform's good at reading remote state. You don't need another tool to read remote state. It's native. And the goal was to rely on Terraform as much as possible to do all the heavy lifting always. But that presented a problem. What if you don't control those components? Some other team does, and you can't modify them. What if you have a brownfield environment and you just want to start using Atmos and you can't change all your components? You still want to get the benefits. What if another thing that came up is, what if Terraform pre 1.6 and OpenTofu and Terraform BSL have different ways of reading outputs? And I forget exactly the nuance there, but yes, because the remote state, the way your Terraform remote state works and how it accesses your IAM roles changed between those versions. So now because we were so adamant about using Terraform, we had this other problem that it didn't work consistently across OpenTofu and Terraform. Well, all of those problems go away now because Atmos now supports this really awesome function called just Atmos component. You give it the name of the component, you say which stack you're operating in, and now you have at your disposal the entire configuration of that component, both its inputs, all the variables that get passed to it, its context, its settings, but also you get its Terraform outputs. And here's an example of retrieving the VPC ID. When you take this in combination with all the other functionality of Atmos, you can now basically take any off-the-shelf Terraform module and turn it into a stateful root module, and then take the outputs of that and use it anywhere else in your infrastructure. And you can do this leveraging all the other benefits that Atmos brings in terms of how it helps you organize, architect, and stand up your infrastructure. So if you're an existing Atmos user, I think you'll really find this helpful. And if you are a newcomer to Atmos, this is going to make it a lot easier to get started for you. Especially when our new docs come out, hopefully by early next week. All right, pausing there. Any questions? Okay. There's been a lot of these posts. Even once upon a time, I think I ran a honeypot. Honeypots are kind of fun because you kind of learn about the dark side, the shadow side of the internet, all these things, all these rogue bots, sometimes actual individuals, but mostly automated bots and script kiddies running things out there looking for vulnerable systems. It also a tell on what's currently the hack du jour, because that's what is probably going to be making most of these requests. And the more infected systems there are out there, the more they're going to be running these same strobing scanning systems. So not surprising, the most attacked usernames, root being one of them. But also, look at this. And that turns out to be some default user with a static credential set by default, used by these Polycom IP phones. And then some of these other ones like UBNT, these are Ubiquiti devices, Raspberry Pis, presumably, and so forth. Common passwords used by those systems. And then also an interesting tell is kind of what is the first command they run when they come in, like to survey the landscape or see what can happen. And some of the techniques here, I thought this was interesting, basically reading the executable itself in memory, I believe the memory space, and then outputting that to STD out. I don't recall what this is here though. Looking for specific processes running, in this case, a miner. A lot of these are Bitcoin miners or systems looking to infect the system and run Bitcoin software. And they don't like to share the wealth either. They described one of these here. The first thing that it does is check if any other miners are running and then kill them. Forget where it is here, but yeah. And the usual stuff. Wipe out the SSH config, add your own key, make it hard for everyone else, and move on. Moving on. I kind of felt dated all of a sudden when, I did, obviously I use LS a lot. I'm on the command line a lot. I always have my colors enabled, but I didn't realize the cool kids had moved on to LSD. And it's a just a fancier way of showing your file system. It adds icons representing files and folders, color codes things. It's themable. I don't really love this theme here. It's ugly as hell, but the fact that you can skin it so it's your style is pretty awesome and so forth. When I found that, then I also saw some other tools like this. This was actually trending on Hacker News, which is what led me down this path, which is another one. And it adds distinct columns in your LS output. So if you like just beautifying your terminal experience, I feel like Shell has made a resurgence over the last couple of years, especially with the help of Charm Bracelet coming up with great UI library. And there's something nice about just the basics of it. All right, moving on. Or anyone have something to add to LS things? Aaron? Aaron, I see you raised your hand. You're muted. All right, moving on. So package management. This has come up many times over the years on office hours. Helm started off as the best way to do things with Kubernetes. And then, as people got deeper and deeper in it, it's like, why are we templating YAML when YAML is supposed to be like a format to make it convenient both for machines and humans to work with it. So why template it? Generate it. So Helm has got a lot of flack for that. It was supposed to be fixed, I think, in Helm 3 and maybe in Helm 4. There's some news on like supporting other ways of managing those resources. Well, other products have come out over the years to do that. Like the most popular thing is Customize, but I don't think I don't in my opinion, Customize is not a package system for Kubernetes. It's a way to conveniently, in a template-free way, provision resources in Kubernetes, but it doesn't bundle them up as a single package for distribution. If anything, I mean, unless you think of like a repository as a package, I guess you could, but I don't like that. So Helm, in my book, is still a very valuable way of distributing apps in Kubernetes because it allows you to package that up and anyone can use them and it parameterizes them. So it's highly reusable. I think it's also a contributor to why Kubernetes has been so successful because it has that system. Well, what's interesting is now I see some new tools coming out that get it. Like, I think it's still really valuable to have packages, just like Docker has images that are bundled and easy to get. You need packages for apps, just maybe not using Helm template. Okay, so here comes Yoke, and there's another tool that bring a package concept to Kubernetes. In this case, it's interesting because they use, what was it? I thought it was Webpack, but I think I said the wrong thing. It uses WebAssembly rather to bundle those resources. And then that's the format that any system that can read WebAssembly that can use to translate that to manifests that are deployed onto Kubernetes. And then any system that can generate those can be used to describe the service you're trying to deploy. So if you build something that you can compile down to the format of the expected format of the WebAssembly package, then Yoke, I believe, is able to deploy that package. The
and
other
the pitch there is that you can then use like you can just then use like your whatever your package manager is like or whatever your language's package manager is to distribute that stuff. So if you're writing it in JavaScript, you can use npm. If you're running in Rust, you can use Cargo. If you're in Go, you can use Go modules, et cetera, to actually describe them as long as the thing that you've compiled it to is WASM, right? I think that's the TLDR.
So you're not dictating how the person who you consumes it has to, what tool chain they have to be familiar with.
Right, yeah.
Like if you're using a Python-based package manager, you're going to have to install just a ton of other dependencies. Some might not work and so forth, despite Python's supposed portability. And this then inspired another tool called Timoni, which I believe might use it under the hood to accomplish the same thing and supports Q as a way of expressing that. So I'm guessing, so you can use Q, then that generates the WebAssembly package that Yoke can deploy. Also, I thought it was interesting. They had a explanation here. Where was it? Explained somewhere they explained why they called it Yoke, and I thought it was fun explanation. Basically, like all the terminology in the entire nautical space has been claimed by some project there now, so they're changing space to flight, and the yoke is the thing in the airplane you use, right, to control the way you fly. Much like Helm, what Helm is to a plane, a yoke is, sorry, what Helm is to a boat, a yoke is to a plane. So I thought it was a clever play on words. Okay. That was that. All right.
I think just one quick comment on that is that all the articles I've seen about yoke have sort of pitched it as through IAC for Kubernetes. So basically the idea is that you have like a versioned package plus your config like together, and that is like the infrastructure as code for what you're deploying to your Kubernetes cluster. Like that's kind of been like the pitch that I've read, a few articles on it.
So unlike, if I'm interpreting correctly, and not saying that you're an expert, but if I'm interpreting correctly, with Helm, you have the package, but then you have your values file, for example. So you need the combination of those two to deploy it. With Yoke, you're saying you actually bake an artifact that has both of those things together.
Yeah, it's basically they call it like the package is like I forget whatever it is, but they I think it's like a package deployer is basically what they call it. So you're essentially like deploying your versioned artifact to your Kubernetes cluster, and that has all the information inside of it that has all the values and the actual like code itself in a single bundle that gets deployed to your Kubernetes cluster. And that way you have full kind of traceability.
Makes sense. All right. Moving on. Just another interesting old Terraform provider. I don't know how I feel about it. I really feel like dot files are more of a console thing. And if you're using dot files with Terraform, you're probably doing something wrong because you should be running this in a CI context. And in a CI context, what are dot files doing for you? That said, it was a Terraform provider to support dot files. If that makes sense for you, something to consider. Next.
Does it, I'm curious though on that, does it, because Terraform can't read, Terraform is boxed, right? So it can't read environment variables directly. It can only read environment variables that are prefixed with the like TF underscore or whatever. So I wonder if it's like, does it let you read in an environment variable directly? I didn't actually see this one, so.
Yeah, they don't. I get what you're saying. Yeah, so basically, if you want to set via environment variables, your Terraform variables, they have to be prefixed with TF on cap all uppercase TF underscore var all uppercase, I believe, underscore,
Yeah.
and then Terraform variable. So I don't believe that it's doing that. Well, based on their description here, they don't mention doing anything like that. But there are other reasons you might want to have it, like your Datadog credentials or something. API key could be in that dot file. God forbid you commit that dot file. So make sure you add those to your gitignore.
Yeah. It's interesting.
Yeah. All right. Next announcement was moving on to actually here. So this was really interesting. Again, I think a recurring theme that I'm starting to see more and more of is that competition is good. I how do you say? HashiCorp seems to be picking up the pace on suddenly acknowledging and trying to resolve some things that people have been complaining about for a very long time. And we see that in the forthcoming 1.9, which I'll talk about right after this. 1.9, RC2 just dropped, so we'll talk about that. But in 1.10, they're adding this concept of ephemeral values. And ephemeral values will not be stored in the state. And that was the whole problem, right? That's why OpenTofu finally addressed the issue about having encrypted state files for multiple reasons. One of them is your secrets may contain state. The other is it helps you, have a cryptographic certainty that the state wasn't tampered. As other researchers have shown, you can actually tamper your state and have Terraform apply it. Even when I believe it, how you say, even when that data wasn't shown in the plan file itself. So basically, the Terraform state is not reconciled with the desired state in the source control. And if you can tamper the state file, then you can impact the infrastructure. So encryption is still important. That said, I do like this idea. Let's not even have the secrets in there to begin with. And that's what they're experimenting with in 1.10. So, on a running theme of competition is good, just can't help but feel like HashiCorp's a little bit like. Everything comes back to relationships, right? And for me, sometimes it's like in a relationship and you break up. And after you break up, you just try and show, I'm fine. I'm totally fine. I don't need you. I'm doing this. I'm doing this. I'm doing this. Everything's good. HashiCorp has a new spunk to their step. So in the release notes for the beta one of, they don't show the release notes here. Let me go back to beta one release notes here. They talk about adding template string. Link to the wrong thing, I guess. Hold on. Go to releases. Go to beta 1.9, beta one. Yeah, here we go. Here are the release notes. Where does it say? Here we go. Like, I've wanted this for so long in Terraform, and Terraform used to support template strings, and it was in a provider, but then they stopped making versions of the provider for our, like M1s and M2s, et cetera, for ARM. But you could fork that repo and do it yourself. So we've been doing that at Cloud Posse. And then there's a long thread, I believe, in HashiCorp on like why they're not supporting template strings, like rationalizing it over and over and over again. And then now suddenly mea culpa, okay, we're adding template strings. Or is it just to force incompatibility between HashiCorp, Terraform, BSL licensed like Terraform and OpenTofu? Unless OpenTofu now adds this function, right? So ultimately, good for users. So no complaints there. I just find the timing so curious. All right. Any comments on either 1.10 forthcoming and 1.9? Or sorry, both are forthcoming, 1.9 being the one dropping any day now.
So tofu is still only on 1.7, right? And I assume 1.8 is around the corner.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have any insight on the timeline for that, but yeah, that's presumably what they're working towards.
Yeah, I haven't spot checked this information, but assuming that's the case, it feels like many years ago when Chrome came out, Firefox is like on 4 something, and then Chrome started incrementing very quickly and went from like 1, 2, 3. Now we're like on 100 something. And then
Yeah.
Firefox changed their versioning scheme to also be majors. And then now you have, I just checked Firefox is at like version 100 something now after being on 4 for so long. So I just wonder if we're going to see, like, I feel like tofu should just increment the major and just get a 2. And,
The optics of it would be interesting, right? If they changed it. Yeah, that's not a bad
mean,
idea.
the speed definitely seems faster, but I haven't spot checked to look at what the old minor release cadence was on Terraform prior to tofu versus now. So kind of to your point of there's a lot of new features coming out.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see, that covered that. And oh yeah, this one here. I admit I first skipped this whole part here that said RFC, and I was like, oh, this is awesome. We need exactly this feature right now. This is gonna merge soon. Awesome. But no, it was an RFC. So this is not there yet. What this is a proposal to support a convention similar to overrides, but based on the tool chain, if you will. So, OpenTofu has a flavor of HCL that isn't directly compatible, perhaps, with the HashiCorp flavor of HCL for Terraform. So, how do you reconcile those differences? So, taking a step back, if you're familiar with the overrides concept in Terraform, it's really valuable. It's similar to almost like monkey patching in other languages, or swizzling, as I learned in React, or sorry, Docusaurus. But it allows you to create some a copy of the desired code and only change the parts of it that you want to change locally, without having to impact the upstream. So overrides work that way. You create a underscore overrides.tf file in your repository, and you can safely pull down or vendor in upstream code into your repository and change how that works. Okay, so with the tofu extension, it is that, but for tofu. And remember how I was describing this problem that we had with Terraform Remote State changing how it works between 1.5x and 1.6, and therefore working differently in the MPL Terraform and the BSL Terraform and HashiCorp and OpenTofu. Well, this will help us in that situation. If we want to try and maintain as much backwards compatibility with MPL HashiCorp Terraform. So you can create files, let's see here, with the extension .tofu .tf or tofu .vars here, like tfvars. Well, this is here's the standard tfvars could be .tofu .tfrs, I believe, and or no, .tofu vars, here we go. I said the wrong thing, .tofu vars, and then .tofu vars .json would be reads only by OpenTofu then.
Yeah, all these concepts of doing this two different ways and having override files and, you know, things that take precedence over one another and everything just keep leading me to believe that a declarative language is not the proper way to be deploying infrastructure. Like, these are all like programming concepts that we're trying to hack into a declarative language because we don't have support for things that are like composing, you know, composability and you know, interfaces and inheritance and, you know, all of those kinds of things in that we have in programming languages.
But even in the programming languages, you still find yourself monkey patching. I mean, even in the formal languages.
No, I mean, not if things are implemented in an object-oriented way, right? Like, you would essentially have an interface that says, like, you know, I need a state interface that would get passed in that says, like, write to state, and then you would be able to pass in your own implementation of a state provider that does what you need it to do in this case, rather than have, like, you know, crazy overrides where you have to write the code over again, you know, to do that.
This is not, well, I mean, I don't know. It's still like, take your example of the interface, but the interface now doesn't expose a checksum of my state. And I wanted that, but I can't get it into the core and I need this done yesterday. So I can just use monkey patching to now add a function that emits the, say, checksum of that state. I don't have to fork the whole thing. I don't have to copy the whole thing. I don't have to rewrite the whole thing. I can just, depending on my language, monkey patch it. This is similar to that, in my opinion. And you see that even in the formal languages and frameworks that I've been looking at.
Yeah. My reaction to this whole thing is because I think monkey patching is such a bad practice because it changes the user expectation of what global things should do, you know, in general, without understanding like the whole thing. So,
no, monkey patches are an escape hatch, and this is an escape. And use escape hatches as escape hatches. Don't use them as your, design architecture.
Yeah, and I guess I just keep coming back to the more things that we release so that we can do monkey patching, if you want to call it that in this case, the more indicator it is to me that we're using the wrong base technology to do some of these things. Like, this is my philosophical discussion, you know, at a high level. Like, this, the whole declarative language, like the fact that how many hoops we jump through to do conditionals in HCL and how many things we do to, you know, to be able to override certain parts of code in certain scenarios and all of that just seem like more and more I see this, more and more leads me to believe that this is the wrong technology solution to the problem, like long term. So I don't want to get off on a whole tangent on that. Sorry. It's just my that was my gut reaction to seeing yet another way to you know, patch something.
Yep. All right. I think that was, did I have anything else? Let's see here. Oh yeah, just another today I learned. There's it's interesting. FBI.com was such a cesspool of sites for a while, or like marketing scams or clickbait or malware distribution, things like that. Ultimately, FBI somehow acquired it. I didn't look into the details on it. For some time, it redirected to FBI.gov, but they stopped doing that. And now it's just permanently routed to 1.7.0.0.1, and including the wildcard. So this is kind of cool if you are doing demos or need a host name for any of the things that you're doing that isn't localhost. For example, for Kubernetes ingress on K3s, you can show off to all your friends how you hacked the FBI, and you can prove it to them. And I guarantee you, like 99% of the people, who are in our industry or do what we do, probably wouldn't know the difference between FBI.com and FBI.gov. All right.
Yeah, I don't know. Like public, public DNS with RFC 1918, return values to me just seems like something that we should not allow on the internet. The same way that we should not allow like anyone to route RFC 1918. Space across. So RFC 1918, for anyone not familiar with that, is all the private address space in IPv4 that are reserved for non-public, non-runnable IP addresses. So it's the 127 here, and then your 10, 10.0.0.0/8 and 192.168.0.0/16 and all of those other all of those other non-routable addresses. This is like the DNS protocol on the internet should somehow prevent us from being able to do that, because it's imagine all the things that someone could do with this when you think you're going somewhere, if they could start some sort of service on your machine, or you think you're directing a request to an external to an external address, but then it's really targeting your local machine. Just seems like a really bad idea to me, and not something that the FBI should be promoting.
Yeah, I was thinking some of those same things, because this could be used for you to kind of almost hack yourself. Or think that you're going somewhere safe, but it's really connecting to malware installed on your local host to do something.
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of my point there.
So I thought it was suspect, therefore, that they would do this and just not have it return nothing, or just have it return nothing, rather.
Well, I'd love to know the reason why they can't redirect it to FBI.gov. Like, that seems crazy to me.
Yeah.
I'm curious if
I don't have a source on.
what no. What's a little suspect to me is FBI, the who is for FBI.com is not the FBI. It,
Interesting. Who is it?
it's actually it's actually registered on two cows. And all the
Ah.
contact information is redacted. So I don't actually believe the FBI owns
Oh, interesting. Yeah,
this.
let's. Does the FBI own FB?
No, I mean, clearly they would have the FBI like SOC, yeah, if you looked at, yeah, so like the registrar for FBI.gov is the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, CISA. And they have like all that, and they have different, a different set of, people.
I
So,
think I was misinformed probably
yeah.
on the history of FBI. All right, interesting. This, according to, I mean, yeah, this is who knows what here, but according to Name Corp, it's actually owned by the same company that owns Recipes Peanut Butter.
Yeah, it's owned by the NSA. This is like no, it's no, it's like, but if you actually look at the Whois information, it's not even like registered with the same DNS services or anything else.
So no
So
affiliation. Interesting. Huh.
it took me a minute to get there because I was like, this doesn't make sense what they're doing. They're actually promoting like